when a man rings our organization, that no matter what the issue is, whether it's around they're looking for training in terms of health and well-being, or whether they are a perpetrator of domestic violence, or whether they are a victim of domestic violence, they will be heard.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast. My name is Fergal Fox, and today we're talking with CEO of the Men's Development Network, Sean Cook, about their work in the area of men's health and a lot more besides. As always, if you'd like to get in touch with us about the podcast, please send us an email at healthandwellbeing.communications@hse.ie, and that email address is in the podcast information wherever you're listening to this. We also ask, please share this episode with a colleague or friend who you may think would benefit or who might be interested in this topic. So today, as I said, we're talking with Sean Cook from the Men's Development Network. And the Men's Development Network have been one of our trusted Section 39 agencies for some time now in the area of men's health. Sean, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Delighted to be here, Fergal. Thanks very much for the invitation.
So, Sean, can you give us an outline of the work of the Men's Development Network?
Yeah, I suppose the interesting thing about the Men's Development Network that it is established nearly 27 years, and I think probably most people don't realise that it's been on the go for so long. And it initially established itself around fathers supporting each other to be better partners and fathers and, you know, and better men, and that's what they originally came about. But as part of that support work and working in circles with men, it became very involved in the area of men's health. And that's an original kind of core pieces of work were very much around that type of work in terms of men's health and the social determinants affecting men's health in terms of this work. So health and working in circles with men was a kind of core activity of the organization.
I don't think maybe some of our listeners would appreciate what working in circles means. You know, so you might have to break that down a little bit because it's...
Sure. I suppose working in circles for us is around, they are supportive circles. In other words, that you sit with groups of people, whether they be men or women or young people, in a group whereby you support each other and it's a really safe environment in which to engage in the conversation, to reflect on various different situations. But it's done in a way whereby you're in a non-judgmental space, you're in a safe space, you're being respected, you're given time, you're given opportunity in which to express your feelings or express your ideas or your attitudes in relation to something without being judged. And it's also a space where, if facilitated well, you're also given the opportunity to take responsibility for yourself in terms of, so a lot of the work is around I statements in terms of that. I feel this and I feel that, or this is what happened to me, as opposed to saying the royal we. So it's a very much around a supportive environment that's non-judgmental. And it's also where it is a strength space where you concentrate on people's strengths rather than on the weaknesses or things that they have to do and fix.
Okay, so that seems like a very sound way of working. And how does, and then the kind of component parts of your work then, let's call them out now so people get an appreciation.
Yeah, and so like we are an organization that works developmentally in the area of health and well-being, gender equality and ending gender-based violence. And we do that by trying to engage men and boys in those particular areas. And we would use that foundation or that core stone of working in circles to create those spaces for those conversations to happen with young men and women, young men and men generally, around their health and well-being. So as we know, certainly around health and well-being, there's always been a sense that men don't talk about their health or they don't seek support and they don't do various different things like that. So when you go into when you invite men and boys into a situation to reflect on their health and well-being, into a self space, they then have the opportunity in which to talk about.
So it's even
being judged
so,
around the fears that they might have. And all of those things around social conditioning, which are the things that are lived experience, which tell boys and men about how they should behave. Like, men are not meant to be weak. They're not meant to be sick. They're meant to be in charge. They're meant to be all these various different things that are aspects that are imposed upon men and can sometimes be harmful for men if they try to live up to them.
So I suppose
that work is very much around the health and well-being. The gender equality is a significant part of our work, which is very much around saying we are conscious that men need to be allies in relation to creating situations of equality, and they need to step into those spaces and support the strive towards equality. And then the follow-on from that really is around the whole idea about ending gender-based violence and very much, again, men stepping into the conversation. We know, and I suppose it's very difficult sometimes to say, we know that a lot of men are really appalled by violent behavior, whether it's domestic violence or sexual violence. But we need to create conditions where they can step into the conversation, become allies and become advocates of change in relation to that area.
Okay, well, we might come back to that. But starting with the health and well-being work and that kind of conversation that you talked about the social conditions that men are raised in or the expectations, it seems to be that you're trying to create a space to liberate that social pressure on men. Is that fair?
I think that would be a very fair way in which to explain it. You know, we are trying to dismantle some of those traditional norms that exist, you know, that and where those expectations of how men should behave. Like, I think we've all heard the anecdotal stories of the wife who puts out the tablets in the morning for the husband to take, you know, and you know, all these type of things that were which lives up to the notion that men don't take responsibility for their own health themselves. It'd be the wife saying, you should go out for a walk, or you should, you know, you should get a bit of exercise, you know, or don't be eating that. And all these type of things are there. And I suppose, you know, those things happen. We know they do. But I suppose that the big challenge is to encourage men to actually, first off, reflect that they can be vulnerable to ill health. This can happen, and that they need to take responsibility themselves in addressing that particular ill health. And I think this is probably more obvious in the mental health area in terms of where people, their sense of well-being and their mental health. So I think this is where we are. What we're trying to do is to kind of force away, eradicate the stigma attached to being unwell, whether physically or mentally. And especially as men, to take away that stigma that you're not weak and you're not creating those kind of spaces where you won't seek out help and you won't seek out support because you feel ashamed of what's going on, and that your previous experience and your previous note of what it is to be a man would very much tell you, I should not be weak. I should not be sick.
The vulnerability is masked, or you know, there seems to be pressure to mask a vulnerability of various types.
It's a strange word, and I've when I came into this work myself, I was always saying, God, why do we have to talk about vulnerability? Because that seems such a weakness, you know, in its own sense, you know. And I've always said, listen, concentrate on, like, you know, people are strong and they have these things, like, you know, but they get moments of vulnerability. And I think when you talk about it in terms of those moments of vulnerability, people can say, yeah, listen, by and large, I'm a strong individual and I do well, but like, there are times when I can be extremely vulnerable, you know, whether it's under stress or whether it's because of ill health or physical ill health. So the vulnerability bit that's one of the biggest challenges, I think, for men to accept that they are vulnerable.
Yeah.
You know, but also to get an understanding, what do we mean by being vulnerable? Like, do we see vulnerability being a real weakness? You know, is it, you know, you're cowering in the corner, you know, you don't know how to stand up for yourself, you know, there's a real kind of cloud around the word vulnerability. That's not what's necessarily meant, you know. It really does mean that you're vulnerable at a particular point in time, like as we all are. Like, we're vulnerable to stress, we're vulnerable to being sad and upset, we're vulnerable to be angry, you know.
Yeah, there's so much tied up with the words, and we all have the baggage around the words. But sometimes I feel that you know, the men find it difficult to be emotionally expressive or to show certain types of emotions because they're not seen as manly. I often think, you know, that all, you know, so many manly men that I know, and manly in inverted commas, but like they're also vulnerable with their wives and their partners and their children, and sometimes we don't see enough of that, or sure, you know, that's kind of hidden, you know. So I think that, like, men are playing it all types of ways.
I think it is hidden, Fergal, but I think they are very private moments also, you know, like, why should you be presenting them out there into the public, you know? I think I thought it was interesting, you see, that people say, they call men crying when they're singing the national anthem vulnerable. I think you have to, you know, is that necessarily vulnerability? I'm not so sure, but it's certainly an emotion, and it's certainly they're empathizing and they're in a space.
Yeah,
that it actually presents the fact that they have an emotional intelligence or an emotional awareness of what they're feeling at the time, which is around pride, and they feel amazing that they are representing their country, that they have achieved so much to be standing there listening to this type of thing. But I think when we talk about men being vulnerable or being emotionally expressive, like, you know, we must remember that the majority of times when people are emotionally expressive, they are in very intimate moments. Like, you know, you don't really want to be stepping into a podcast and talking about your most intimate moments of vulnerability, you know. And yet people do it, which is, I think, is amazing. And they're fantastic champions, you know. And there's lots of men, and more recently, in more recent times, where men are coming forward and talking about their own vulnerabilities, which are based around their sickness or their illness or their mental health. And it is fantastic that these men are significant champions in trying to dismantle, first off, the notion that you can't be vulnerable and you shouldn't be vulnerable and you shouldn't be weak. They're championing the notion of saying, you need to seek help and you need to seek support. You don't have to deal with this on your own. You don't have to take the lead and charge of it. Sometimes you need to succumb to somebody taking care of you, which is, that's a big thing to kind of do for some men, because they've always felt that their role was the one to be the carer and the one in charge of that and to make sure that everybody was okay. And when they get sick, it really does create dysfunction for them around their own role and where they fit in
Role. I think that takes us into the men's health work that you do, you know, so there's the group work, but in terms of the strategic work and the national work, I know that Men's Health Week every year has been a big promotional opportunity and activation for you. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, and I think like Men's Health Week as a week is really important around kind of keeping, I suppose, the high priorities of men's health on the agenda. And I think that like it's a really fantastic example of collaboration and partnership across the island, you know, north and south. I think it's, you know, under the auspices of the Men's Health Forum for Ireland. But we've been working with the MHFI, or I'd say it's probably nearly 15, 20 years now at this stage, especially around developing men's health and supporting, kind of creating awareness around men's health. And I think one of the really good things it's done is has created those teams. You know, each year it has a team. Like this year, it's about know your numbers, you know, in terms of whether it's your weight or whatever. You know, there's lots of different things around your blood pressure or whatever it is. Like, it's get to know your numbers around your life. And those teams are really, really good because it allows you to create really strong promotional material and focus on issues so that you get the message across and that you allow all those other stakeholders to get involved with Men's Health Week. And I think that's really the incredible thing around it at Men's Health Week, is the amount of stuff that happens over the week to generate awareness, to keep men's health as a priority and work within it. And we do our own stuff in terms of Men's Health Week, in terms of Men's Development Network, whether we're going to do something here locally in Waterford, where our head office is, and working with, I think, the Sports Partnership and the Local Development Agency. And that's around just raising awareness around the community organizations that are involved at working with men, to let everybody know about the services that are available there for them as well within the health context. So we'll do that. But I think Lorcan, our training and resource development manager,
he's been a national voice as well as a regional voice.
And that sometimes being the voice of Men's Health Week because he loves getting onto the L radio and doing whatever he has to do, you know. But I his work there in supporting that committee and helping those events and promoting those events are really, really important. And actually this year, we're in the middle of developing a memorandum of understanding with the National Forum for the Resource Centres.
Okay.
And we're not in the middle, we're probably near the end of it. And one of the things is about using the network of family resource centres to, first off, to help them be more, I suppose, attractive to men to go into, to seek support in, but also to be able to use the network of the FRCs to promote things like Men's Health Week or cancer, you know, the cancer weeks and stuff like that, to kind of use that network and support them in developing little things that they might want to do. So that's the type of work that we've been involved with the Men's Health Week. And I think it also, the Men's Health Week drives a lot of other partnerships that you wouldn't see before. They all of a sudden you see people talking to each other about something else, which is really, really important, which is there. And it's a critical part of our own work that we work in collaboration. One of our core values is around partnership and collaboration. And so it's really important when we sit into this that we avail of people. And just when we go back to the whole idea around our involvement in men's health, we started to get involved with men's health when we were asked to do some work, developmental work with men who were just left made unemployed, whatever it was. This is going back
20
odd years ago. But one of the key things we found out when we sat into work with these men, that it wasn't that they weren't able to work. It was a lot of other health issues that were preventing them from going into work. And so the idea of men's health became very, very important to us. And the first thing we tried to do then was to kind of, rather than reinvent the wheel, was to develop those relationships and collaboration. So working with MHFI, working with yourselves in the HSC, with Noel Richardson inside the National Men's Health Centre in Carlow, was really important. And I think that collaboration also brought about a significant development of the first ever men's health policy in the country, in the world, to emerge out of that. So those type of collaborations are really important. And I think the Men's Health Week is a real example of that.
Yeah, and just to call out to all our listeners that Men's Health Week is open for business now. Like it runs in June right up to Father's Day, the week preceding Father's Day. And if you want to get in touch with mhfi.org, Colin and colleagues will be more than happy to support you in any way that you can. But I think the key point that you're saying, Sean, is it's collaborations, building on collaborations and partnerships. And it's great to hear that of your work with the Family Resource Centres. That's an exciting development.
Yeah, it is. And I'm like, we're doing some work. Like one of the other areas, the area of work that we're involved in, as you know, is that we run a number of national programs around domestic violence, and intervention program, but also we run the free phone line service for male victims of domestic violence. And then we have a national program of client support workers on the ground regionally. So, and we're trying to dovetail them in with the family resource centers as well.
Right.
And very much around trying to create a standard of care and a standard of delivery of work around working with male victims of domestic abuse. So it is a very exciting time, I think, around with the forum and with the various different family resource centres, which we've had relationships individually, but it'd be nice to get something on a national level with it. I think it'd be really, really important. And they're mad keen to get involved in, you know, they want to do stuff around Men's Health Week. But sometimes you just need the direction about what can we do? And it could be a coffee morning, And I think that's the most important thing, is that if anybody is listening and they're thinking of doing something over the week of June around Men's Health Week, that they let the forum know so that they can promote that work as well for them as part of the national.
Yeah, we've seen a growth of so many small organizations and community groups, and Lawrence Gohan in the West from Health Promotion, Health and Wellbeing there, he recently presented on one of our webinars about the work that they did in Galway, Roscommon and Mayo around men's health. And there was a lot of family resource centres involved in that, doing things, like you said, small things, bigger things, but community engagement and getting men in the door. I want to bring you on to the Engage training, Sean, because you've been leading out on that in collaboration with Health Promotion and Proven staff across the country. So can you explain to our listeners, you know, what does that do exactly?
Engage is a national men's health training program, and it originated out of the first ever men's health policy, when it was identified that it was a requirement, really, if the policy was to be fulfilled, that we needed to train frontline service providers on how to engage men around their health and well-being. And so Engage was established as a consortium of the HSC, MHFI, ourselves, and the two individual universities at the time, Waterford and Carlow IT, which is now CETU Carlow and Waterford, where we came together and developed a suite of trainings, which were train the trainers, where we trained key personnel within organizations on introducing the notion of engaging men around their health and well-being and increasing their capacity. So that's the origins of Engage. And as I said, it developed a range of different suites of trainings, from connecting with young men to connecting with men, to men on the move, to men in the middle, and to On Firm Ground, which is the most recent iteration. But more recently as well, that Engage, we kind of amalgamated a number of units into one major unit, which is called Connecting with Men. And that has been rolled out and delivered. In fact, yesterday there was a two-day train-to-trainer program was delivered yesterday and the day before in Athlone with a number of HCP staff and other agencies, including kind of in the business world or in the commercial sector, private sector, where some of the key champions for men's health within those organizations came in and did the train-to-trainer program, which is fantastic.
It's great to see the growth of men's health into workplaces, that program, that Engaged training can be taken by, you know, the HSE staff and others to help community organizations and a variety of people working in the health and social care arena sharpen their tools in relation to engaging men and supporting men when they do come into the service?
One of the critical things around these trainings, and I suppose the biggest input that, like, we coordinate the program nationally, but I think we've also had a role in, along with the rest of the consortium, in terms of developing the materials, but also the methodology of sitting into the room and engaging with the people in that room as part of the training has been a critical part of kind of getting the message out. And the same thing is about allowing people to sit into the room without judgment around what they haven't done or what they have done around attracting and working with men and their health. But I think the critical thing is also giving them the chance to reflect on what are the areas where subconsciously or with that unconscious bias that they haven't thought about those critical issues in terms of engaging men. And I think that's one of the best things about the program, is about giving a sense to people about if a man turns up and sits in front of you, where they are coming from at that point. You know, what's the situation where they're at, and allowing them to be able to kind of sit in and have that conversation and feel supported at the time. So given those skills are really, really vital, you know, and I think the development of on firm ground, if you don't mind, I'll go into that, Fergal, because I think there's an element of where it's nearly a natural progression, where we started to think about, in some ways, what happened was somebody came to us having done the Connecting with Men program and said, you know, this would be really useful in the agricultural sector. You know, there's lots going on there. And there was various pieces of work that are done, being completed by Noel inside the National Men's Health Centre in Carlow, like with around Farmers Have Hearts and other various different programs that had been developed, that there was a sense that there was the definite gap. First off, for people who live in rural Ireland and working in the rural and agricultural sector, around people were extremely conscious of the stresses and strains of that work, what was actually happening in modern day Ireland, working in that area. And I think initially they thought that this is about this program would be brilliant for farmers to do. But I suppose we brought it back in, you know, to say, well, listen, maybe the way to do this is to develop a training program, train the trainer program, which would train farm advisors on engaging with farmers over the farm gate. And I suppose really important to say that this work that we're asking advisors to do is to be health connectors. It's not to be therapeutic, you know, psychologists or Sigmund Freud. It's very much to be able to spot the signs, ask the motivational question, and then signpost people to the work to the areas of work.
Yeah, but it's great. It's great that your ambition, I suppose, as you said, you sat back and looked at it. How are we going to get to farmers?
Yeah.
How are we going to get to rural Ireland? And you had to go through people that are already getting to farmers in a way, you know, and the agricultural sector, you know, the on-farm ground, just the people that mightn't have heard about it before, it has been a new development in recent years. And the Department of Agriculture and Marine have really been a driving force for this, haven't they, Sean?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think this is the incredible thing about it. I know we've been always knocking on the door to various different places to see, can we get in the door? But all of a sudden, there was the Department of Agriculture knocking on their door saying, we really want to get this in. And they really saw the value in the program of saying, like, well, I suppose the Department of Agriculture were acknowledging that there are serious existential threats to farming in Ireland, you know, and to farmers in Ireland. I think that it's only when we started into work to realize just the stresses and strains that are on it are really incredible. Like, you know, and that a lot of farmers now are working full time, but they're also
they're full time businessmen and they're full time operational as well.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. So it is.
Yeah,
it is.
There's massive stuff, and then there's all the stuff in terms of the regulations and I think one of the biggest stresses on farmers at the moment now is that they feel that they are the cause, or they feel that they are being presented as the cause to our environmental and climate breakdown, you know. So, and people a lot of farmers take these things very, very seriously, because they actually all saw themselves as the custodian of the lands, you know.
Yeah.
Like, so for that to be challenged is a serious challenge to them. And I'm sure a lot of that is heartbreaking and stressful to hear. But one of the things, though, was that we did see that these advisors were dealing with farmers on a day-to-day basis. And I think one of the interesting things that struck us around the program was that when we started looking at it, even the farm advisors were under significant stress as well, in terms of, you know, the concern that they had. And this is one of the biggest things about them.
And these farm advisors, just to make it clear, some of these guys are working for the state in the likes of Teagasc, and some of them are independent agricultural advisors. Isn't that right?
Advisors, yeah. So they would support the farmers in terms of making their applications for CAP and the various other kind of programs that they have as support, whether it be around derivatives and derrigation and, you know, what's the other one they have around the hedging? I can't forget what it's called. So they would kind of help them make their applications and draw down their grants to them and do those type of things. But that work is all very time sensitive, you know. And there's lots of, you then have to do training to do this work. So when you, it's always one, I always say to people here in our organization that sometimes success can bring a lot more problems, you know, because then you start looking at development program, and then you look at when you're delivering this, you begin to identify other gaps that need to be resolved within that work. And this became very, very obvious, I think, in terms of the farm advisors, you know, in terms of the supports that they need. To be clear, because I think we have had numbers of situations where farm advisors would leave a farmer having had a disclosure of some sort, and they don't sleep that night because they don't know whether they gave the right direction or the right support. And so this is what On Farm Ground offers.
And that advisor obviously has a sense of, I might be the only person that farmer has told that information to.
Absolutely, yeah. So there's lots of they also need to be aware, and this is what the program offers. It gives them that real guidance and gives them the understanding of their true boundaries and what they're responsible for and what they're not responsible for. And that alleviates a lot of stress for a lot of the farm advisors, but it also allows them to enter into a space like a farm yard where a farmer might be under pressure, and to be able to talk them through that and signpost them in the most appropriate way without them getting freaked out themselves.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's critical there. But I suppose the amazing thing about On Farm Ground has been there's a second iteration of Farm Ground because of the success of the first one. The Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and yourselves and the HSE saw real merit in extending this out to other agricultural professionals in the sector, you know. And so there's a second iteration of Farm Ground now that's working with community vets and the departmental vets and other agricultural professionals, whether it be around the tech staff as well, around the department and more, and the younger advisors coming into the program. So it's been fantastic in that we have the training program now is accredited by the Veterinary Council as well. It gives CIPD credits to people who do the program. So we're going after now all of the vets and veterinary nurses and veterinary assistants, as well as agricultural professionals and technicians within the department and various other areas. So that's a program that's been rolled out now because of the extent of the program and because of the learning that we got from doing the train-the-trainer program. It became fairly obvious that we wouldn't be in a position to do or have an expectation that vets would take on the role of being trainers themselves.
Yeah.
So we put in place, we've now got a training team, and we've also developed a whole load of online resources now available around the program. So that's it's in the process of being rolled out. First session, I think, is a session starting next week. There's 25 vets already lined up and signed up to do the program.
So that's great. So you're really trying to influence the sector by putting that capacity and enabling those male-friendly conversations. Isn't that it?
Yeah. But I think it is creating that safe space.
Yeah.
I think it's and what we have found, and listen, generally what we find around with men in all of our work is whether you're starting at the basic support circle work to a training and development stuff. And I suppose in engaging with men around, even in training, it's a peer-led environment. And so that when people are in training, that they learn from each other as opposed to being a didactic, here's the patient and the PowerPoint and away you go. So it very much is around encouraging people to talk about their experience of how they do it and what's happened for them. And that's the learning process that's within it. So
I wanted to bring you on to the broader work that you're doing in the Men's Development Network. You mentioned working with male victims of domestic violence and working with male perpetrators of violence.
Yeah.
Like, that seems extremely complex stuff. So,
challenging work.
Okay.
I have to say. But they, like the, our organization, as I said, our work is around engaging men and boys on these kind of three areas of health and well-being, gender equality, and ending gender-based violence. And we do that through a number of, as I say, national programs, whether it be Engage is one, there's White Ribbon is the other, there's the Men Program, and then there's the Male Advice Line. And the organization has two sides to it to some degree. It's like two sides of the same coin. One's around that client support work, and then the other's around the training, development, and advocacy work. But they're all intertwined in how we go about the work, if you understand. Like, so how we engage with men, whether it's around the health and well-being or whether it's around gender-based violence, we do it in the same way. We use the same methodology of engagement. And so it is amazing for us to be able to say, when a man rings our organization, that no matter what the issue is, whether it's around they're looking for training in terms of health and well-being, or whether they are a perpetrator of domestic violence, or whether they are a victim of domestic violence, they will be heard.
Yeah,
and they will be listened to, and they'll be validated in terms of where they're at, and that we can actually respond to the work that we do there. So it might look like they're too, like we do training and development in around health and well-being, and then we're also running a male advice line. It might seem, Jesus, they're so very, very far apart, but they're not. They're essentially how we go about the work. Why are we doing it? And why we're in it there is very much around having that supportive environment for men. It is also about, first of all, like as an organization, we're not a men's rights organization. So it's around that transformative approach.
Yeah, it reminds me of the term that we often use in our work around men's health, around a healthy masculinity.
Yeah.
Being kind of open and expressive, and but needing support, as I said earlier, being able to put up your hand and say you need support at sometimes. How have you seen the kind of national conversation around some of those issues that you're addressing in terms of domestic violence, and how have you heard them in terms of your position in your work?
Well, I tell you, we've kind of, as an organization, just say the context and the environment that's happening at policy level and at educational level and at the societal level has been really, really, we're riding a bit of a crest of a wave.
Yeah.
Fargo. Like, you know, we've gone from 7 staff to 32 staff over the past 4 years, you know, and on all areas of this work, you know, and like we're the only organization that was named in the third national strategy addressing domestic, sexual, and gender-based violence. Like, so what's really important for us is that one of our key objectives is that we influence policy on the most appropriate ways to engage men and boys, you know, and our non-judgmental approach has really been taken on board. We've started conversations with the curriculum unit of the around the SPHE program for schools. And the big conversation we have with them was ensuring that teachers didn't go in with a judgmental attitude in working with boys, that you're inviting those young boys into the conversations around their attitudes to women, their attitudes to their role in the home, their attitudes to healthy relationships, their attitudes to sex.
Yeah.
That when you enter into that conversation with them, that it's an invitation as opposed to, let's go in and we sort you out. I know you have bad attitudes to these things.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that has always been our approach about the work, that it needs to be an invitation, and that avoids the backlash. It avoids the stepping away from, or people kind of blanking us, oh, this is going too far. And it allows people to have an attitude that they have developed through their own worldview and their own world experience that now they know may not be appropriate, you know. So, but it's not blaming them in terms of that. So to answer your question, we have found a situation where that everybody, the Department of Justice, the Department of Education, even the Department of Enterprise and Agriculture are even more susceptible to the concept of engaging men in those positive, active, non-judgmental ways, which allows them to enter into conversation and change those attitudes. And that allows men to be those kind of the activists and the working in alliance and advocates, as advocates for change that is beneficial for them. So yeah, it's been such an exciting time.
Yeah, it sounds encouraging. It sounds really encouraging.
Around these type of changes, and there's a definite attitudinal change, not only from policymakers and influencers, but also in terms of on the ground. I think people are a lot more aware of the challenges it is to be a young man or a boy now in our society. Like, it's not that straightforward. And I think everybody's beginning to acknowledge that.
So, Sean, where should people go for more information of what you've been telling us about?
Well, I suppose the easiest place to go to is our website, which is at www.mensnetwork.ie. And if people are looking for particular resources and supports in relation to domestic violence, if they ring our free phone number, which is 1-800-816-588.
Okay, well, Lucas, we have to wrap this up, but there's so much that we could talk about. You're just after hitting on so many issues there. We might have to have you back onto a podcast with a panel of speakers, because there's so many there's so many deep issues there that you just touched on there towards the end of the conversation. So I really appreciate you kind of outlining that, your ambition, and as you said there's real hope that there's, you know, the change in attitudes and a better understanding of where we need to go with boys and men over the coming years. So thanks very much for coming on today, Sean. And I'd like to thank the listeners for tuning in to another episode of the HSE Talking Health and Wellbeing podcast.
Thank you.